Welcome to the Forbidden Apple Podcast, where we explore the relationship between queer people and religion.
They say faith can move mountains, and we want to know what faith means to you.
Join our conversation as we discuss overcoming prejudices, find common ground, and celebrate our differences. A former Orthodox Jew
and a Spanish-raised Catholic meet weekly and sink our teeth into
the Forbidden Apple.
The Forbidden Apple.
Hi, everybody.
And welcome to another episode of
The Forbidden Apple. I am Melissa Weiss.
I am Pelayo Alvarez.
And today we have with us Yitz Jordan, also known as Y-Love.
I love the name.
It's an awesome name.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We wanted to start with, just to give us a little understanding of who you are, to start with, we wanted to talk about your early child, like your upbringing and how that was.
So I was born and raised in Baltimore, lived in Baltimore my whole life until I was 21, when I would move to New York. Born and raised in East Baltimore. Well, I grew up very close to Johns Hopkins University and the old Memorial Stadium. So geographically, I was what I called ghetto adjacent. My neighborhood was a good neighborhood, but the neighborhood a few blocks away was like gang territory. Geographically, I grew up the exact opposite, geographical opposite from where the Jewish community was. We were totally on the opposite side of town. So I would discover Judaism the first time when I was about 7 years old. I saw a commercial on TV that said Happy Passover, and I went and drew six-pointed stars on everything. And I just realized that there was a group of people called Jews, and I had to be one of them, whatever that meant. And so my mother would go to work the next day and talk to a woman at her job. She would say something that I can't exactly imagine what it entailed, but like, my son wants to be Jewish, what do I do? And they would invite us over for Passover Seder. And that would be my first Seder. And that would be where I would get my first yarmulke from their house, from like whoever's bar mitzvah. Considered that like a magic hat, and I would wear it all the time. My mom would bring me home like challah and stuff like that as a treat. My grandmother wanted to be Jewish her whole life. She would be my translator for the rest of the family. And as I would grow older, like when I was about 9 and I was done with Christmas, she would give me my first menorah. And when I was done with reading Christian scriptures, she would get me my first copy of the Torah and things like that as I would grow up. I grew up raised by my mother for the most part. My dad was the opposite of a deadbeat dad. Instead of sending child support every month, he would send child support every week. And so I grew up a little bit more privileged than some of the other kids in the neighborhood would have been. So I had access to have things like yarmulkes and stuff like that. When I was about 14, I would be cutting across Johns Hopkins University's campus on my way home from school, and I saw a swastika on a billboard, and I went to go see what that swastika was, and it was a lecture on anti-Semitism and the Holocaust at Johns Hopkins University. And somebody said, well, so I would go to that lecture, and somebody said, well, what are you doing Friday night? And that would be my first Shabbat, and then I would just start as much of the conversion process as I could then, started teaching myself Hebrew, and started keeping as many things as I could. Like, Judaism was always something that I was really into. Also, while all of this is going on, I'm hitting puberty, and I'm realizing more and more that I'm gay. So while that's all going on, I'm also discovering myself on like a different level, kind of going to Pride, but not really feeling like I belong there. And that conflict would never really go away until, I guess, Judaism won when I was about 21 and I would move to New York, start the process of conversion, Hasidic process of conversion officially. That, you know, involved moving up from Baltimore, speaking, learning how to speak Yiddish. I actually found my rabbi on convert.org, which lasted 13 months until I was about 22. And then I would go to yeshiva, and then I would start rhyming with my chavrusa in yeshiva in Or Sameach in Jerusalem, my study partner. He and I would start rhyming together as a way to learn better, and I would become why I love. And that's pretty much my early life, all in a nutshell.
Okay, that was amazing. Okay, but I want to backtrack a little bit, okay? Also, Why Love is your, like, Jewish rapper, right? Yeah, you know it as the Jewish rapper.
Yeah, that's my stage name, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the OG original Jewish rapper. There's plenty of Jewish rappers now, and with Nisim being the most famous.
You're the original.
About 20 years ago.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about, like, how amazing it was. It sounds like your parents, like, were supportive. Like, your mom, your grandparents were supportive of your choices. You want to be Jewish. How do I make my son Jewish?
Not really supportive, but, well, supportive in that, like, what would you say to a 7-year-old who was said that they wanted to make a huge life change? It's like, okay, you know, if your kid would have said that they wanted to be an astronaut, you would buy them a space helmet. Your kid says that they want to be Jewish, you buy them a yarmulke. Like, I can get that. I think that as time went on and she realized, like, I'm starting to look different than kids in school. I'm starting to not eat anything leavened during Passover. I'm fasting on Yom Kippur and things like that. Once it started to be like an actual lifestyle, that's when she started to, you know, have problems with it and we would start fighting. We fought nonstop, either because of me being Jewish or because of me being gay throughout my whole teenage years.
I would like to know, because since you didn't really have any direct family connection with Judaism, what made you be so drawn to it?
It was like, just like I said, I knew that there was a group of people called Jews and I had to become one of them. So my mother did what any mother would do. She would say stuff like Jewish boys clean their rooms and Jewish boys eat vegetables and stuff like that. But like, I just knew that whatever Jews did, I had to do. And that Judaism, me learning about Judaism would kind of come out of that, because it was like, it wasn't that, I believe something, so let me go and learn more about Judaism, or Judaism resonates with something inside of me. It was more like, well, Jews believe Judaism, so let me go and learn about Judaism. Like, it wasn't a question of, is this true? It was, well, obviously this is true, so let me just learn more about what it is so I can learn about what the truth is.
So you saw this Passover thing, you were like, that's me. I'm a Jew. Whatever that means.
Whatever that means, right. That's me.
Wow.
I gotta do that. And that's how I approached Judaism, was like, it wasn't a question of, is this true? It was like, all right, let me learn more about the truth, because this is what the truth is. Like, it wasn't a question of, like, do I believe this? It was like, let me find out about what I'm supposed to believe.
Was it as clear knowing that you were gay as knowing that you were Jewish?
By high school, I was already... So while this was going on this track, like, there's, you know, I'm discovering my identity. I'm learning about organizations like ACT UP and Queer Nation and all of the other activist groups that were out during the early 90s with HIV activism and things like that. I joined my local, well, at the time, gay and lesbian youth group. Like I said, I would start to go to Pride, but I would never feel like I belonged in certain places. The night I lost my virginity, I actually listened to, like, DeVacus, which is this Jewish group, which is like super, super spiritual music. Think like violins and something you might hear in the background of an epic film. I'm like listening to that, like feeling guilty, feeling like I just did something wrong. And it's not like I couldn't even read Hebrew at that point. So it's not like I knew per se exactly what I did wrong. But it was just felt like I shouldn't have done what I would have been doing because it went against Judaism. Not that I actually had the text to back that up, but it just felt like I did.
Were you still going to church at this point with your family? Was your family going to church?
I would stop going to church when I was about 13, 12 or 13. I don't think I would have gotten any bad messages about homosexuality from anyone except my mom. Once I would, you know, come out to her when I was also about 13, 14. I would first start coming out to people online. And this is way before the internet. This is like, you know, early 90s. So this would be on bulletin board systems. I would call up, you know, dial up on my dial-up modem to the BBS. And, you know, that's how I would meet people. And that would be my first introduction into understanding that, like, oh, there's a gay community and things like that. People I would eventually meet, you know, once I would start high school. But that was the summer between eighth and ninth grade was when I first came to terms with, like, the idea of coming out.
So at the same time, you're coming out, you're like this proud, gay, Jewish boy.
Right.
Like, young kid that's just, like, figuring all these identities out for themselves.
At the same time, right.
At the same time. And so when you were invited to, like, a Shabbos meal, and you were you going as an out person? Were you going as somebody that was exploring Judaism? Did they know who you were? Did you feel
I was going as somebody who was exploring Judaism. And was I out? No. But I had, my ears were pierced seven times. I had hair down to here, like over one eye. Was I out? No, but, you know, I don't even know if they would have wanted to ask. It was kind of like a poorly kept secret.
Tell us a little bit more about your conversion, and specifically converting when you want to be Hasid.
Well, okay, there's Orthodox conversion, and then there's everything else. So in the Orthodox world, it's like a little bit more all-encompassing.
Really stringent, isn't it? Isn't it a really, like, tough process?
Right, you're expected to go through the entire Code of Jewish Law at the abridged version, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and you're supposed to live an entire Jewish year. So that means all, you know, every Shabbat, all the holidays, everything until they see that your level of observance is up to where you want to be. Like, I decided, like, that I wanted to be Hasidic. So that's how I was judged. Like, that's how my conduct was looked at. If I would have said I wanted to be, like, modern Orthodox, that might have been different. That was just the path that I chose. And the shortest I've ever heard of conversion lasting was 9 months in America and through the Beis Din that I went through in Brooklyn. And the longest I'd ever heard of it taken was 18 years.
Can we talk a little bit about this idea that when you're trying to convert to Judaism, there's this idea that you need to, they push you away to see how serious you are or stuff. Can you talk a little bit to that?
You're supposed to get pushed away three times. But, okay, so in Baltimore, the way that the Beis Din did it, like, this was when I was in high school, they would say stuff like, okay, the buses don't run, but didn't run between 2 and 5 a.m. I lived a 2-hour bus ride away from the shul. They would tell me to show up before shachar, before morning services. In other words, the buses aren't running. And in other words, I wouldn't be able to get there. Am I dedicated enough to get a taxi? Am I dedicated enough to walk or ride a bicycle there or something? In New York, it didn't even get to that point because there's a line in the Talmud that says a convert's supposed to be pushed away three times. But if you say, why do you want to be a Jew? Don't you know the Jews have been downtrodden and beaten down throughout history? If the person replies, I know and I'm not worthy, they are accepted without any further question. So I went in knowing this by this point. When the rabbi asked me, like, don't you know that Jews are, I just cut off the sentence. I was like, I know when I'm not worthy. And he was like, I can tell you've done your homework. I was like, I'm telling you, I'm doing this. Like, it was like, there was no question of pushing me away.
So there's parts of Judaism, right, that being gay and being Jewish would not be a problem at all. There's, like, different sects in, like, modern Orthodox or just... And I wonder what pulled you towards Hasidic if you knew you have to...
So, like, I wrote about for the JTA. It was everything. The second I discovered Hasidic, like, the first time I met a Chabadnik in Johns Hopkins University and he invited me up to Lubavitch in Baltimore, where I still go when I go to Baltimore... And just everything blew my mind. It was like the whole thing just blew my mind. It was the idea of, I mean, living separate, having your own separate legal system, speaking a different language, having, you know, the style of dress, the cooking, the everything. Hasidic teachings on paper are beautiful. Like, everybody has a spark of the divine inside of them, and you're always connected to God. No matter how hard you try to sever that connection, you're always connected. And God loves you so much that, like he'll turn over the whole Torah just to try to get you into heaven. And Rebbe Levi Yitzchak of Bedichev, like the great Hasidic master from 200 years ago, arguing, like ready to cuss Hashem out, ready to cuss God out, because like, how dare you judge your children unfavorably? Like, there's so many things about Hasidic philosophy that's just beautiful. Set me on fire from the time I first learned about it.
But what about the fact that you had to, then you felt that you can't be a gate man?
See, at the time, I didn't consider it an issue. I considered it like, you know, there's nothing which God can't do. So all you have to do, and God wants you to do mitzvahs. So if God wants me to do mitzvahs, then mitzvahs include getting married and having children, etc. And therefore, I'm going to pray for the ability to do that. And I thought that God would make me straight, period. Like, that's just what would happen. And you pray harder, it doesn't happen. I had an arranged marriage in 2003, a shidduch, when I was 25. And that, to me, was like Hashem telling me no. Like, you know, that was me. It's written underneath the chuppah, when a person stands under the wedding canopy, all of their sins are forgiven. The only things that stop a person's prayers from being answered is the sins that they have. If you didn't have any sins, like a perfectly righteous person, their prayers go directly to heaven. So therefore, underneath the wedding canopy, your prayers should go directly to heaven. Here I am, underneath the wedding canopy, praying directly to heaven for the ability to do a mitzvah that Hashem wants me to do, and I still couldn't do it. That was just, you know, it's obviously, I'm not meant to be straight. I'm meant to be gay. Now, what do you do with that information is a whole separate issue, but that whole marriage and divorce would be like me coming to terms with like no, you for real are gay. Like,
and you can't outpray it. You can't, right. you can't get it away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Were you out in the community? Were you able to leave your homosexuality, be out?
I briefly tried in 2006. I would briefly try having boyfriends. That really wouldn't work in the religious world, just because, I mean, who wants to be with somebody who's so in the closet? And I mean, I joke that there's only 25 heterosexual people in Williamsburg in the Hasidic community. Like, there's so many on the low people hooking up in various different clandestine ways, however they do it, whatever they call themselves. This is my study partner. This is my business partner. This is my this. There's so much of that. It's not like I wasn't hooking up. So I just thought that was like, you know, life. Like, that was what life was going to be like. Like, you have your clandestine hookups every once in a while, and otherwise you're a chassid, you know, and that's it.
What made you change your decision about the person that you wanted to be? And also, I want to know if it was connected with being a rapper.
Oh, so while all of this is going on, while all this is happening, my professional career is blowing up. Why I Love is getting more and more notoriety. I'm going on tours. After someone tried to out me in 2005 by following me to Gay Pride with my boyfriend at the time, and taking pictures of me, and then taking these pictures around to my rabbis in an attempt to get me excommunicated, that would send me into a depression personally for many years, because I would be paranoid about everyone in the community, because I didn't know who saw the pictures or who knew what or who thought what about me. But while all that's happening, Why I Love is blowing up. I'm going, my first mixtape had just dropped, and then after that, my acapella album, and then after that, my album would drop. So going on tour as a public figure while in the closet. And so I had to be closeted around more and more people and in more and more situations.
Sounds painful.
And that's what eventually would lead to 2009. So one mentally ill guy I had met in Borough Park, Hasidic guy, older guy, who told me, this is one of a schnorrer, a person who asks for charity as a living. a person who like lives on begging people for money. And he's one of those people who one could easily dismiss as like, oh, he's like a crazy homeless bum, whatever. And he asks me for money one day, and I had had colored contact lenses in my eyes. And he goes, oh, don't look at me through those contact lenses because I'm about to have to kiss you. And I gave him the money. And then it would hit me months later. I'm like, he's not mentally ill. He's just been closeted for 45 years. And so it would hit me like, this is your future. This is going to be you in 45 years making clandestine comments to guys because you don't know how else to express yourself. It's gonna translate into some type of mental illness. And this is what you're headed for if you don't do something. And so that would start the process of me leaving the community and leaving the closet and eventually coming out professionally. And not just that one incident, but like just this, I just saw life as being, I was on a very bleak track.
Knowing that you were making that choice to leave, I mean, me having left the community was really hard, right? So I understand some of that pain. It feels like you came to this and you created this whole life. And then knowing that you were leaving, you could possibly lose everything and also this career as a Jewish, like Hasidic rapper. So you're losing like your friends, your like new like family, your everything that you've created in your life.
Right.
That, what was that like?
Well, I mean, yeah, it was very scary. And yeah, it wouldn't have happened if I didn't have a whole bunch of support and a whole bunch of people around me, which was another huge plus about having had the professional career, because I met so many people. So it's not like I didn't have support from all types of different angles. So that was a huge plus. But I've posted about this on Off the Derech groups on Facebook. It's kind of mind-blowing how one can go after conversion from being dynamic young adult who's going after what they believe and what they want to chassid who can't leave Brooklyn because you're too paranoid of what the outside world is going to say or do or treat you. Like you said, I was so scared of leaving because, you know, I'm not going to be able to survive outside of the belt. This is all I, outside of the Hasidic world. This is all I know. This is what I've built everything around. I literally had to rediscover everything that I was. I had to rediscover who I was after a while. I say that it took a year to convert, but to go off the derech took about 3 years to really like get a lot of that mindset out of my mind and to really get the community out of me as opposed to me just leaving the community.
At the same time, though, your conversion was to Judaism, which you still consider yourself Jewish, right? You're still proud Jew.
Right. That's one of the reasons why I consider I so hardcore rep being off the derech. Another chassid of my Rebbe said to me back in the day, anything that you're thinking now, anything that you're thinking is being thought with your Gemara-educated brain. Anything that you're thinking now is being thought with a brain that has been trained in Hasidic philosophy, in Talmud, in Torah. So your thought process is different now. So you're not going to think the same things about stimuli now that you would have 10 years ago. So I can never go back. I can never go, you know, I can't undo years of yeshiva learning and living in Borough Park. Like, I'm never going to not be Jewish. I'm never going to not be Orthodox. I'm never going to be, you know, like some kid in a temple somewhere in Nebraska. Like, I'm totally affected and built by 13th Avenue and Avenue J just as much as I am by Baltimore.
I was just going to say that you actually still sound like a chassid. Like the right? Because I think it's also, it's the passion in you. Yeah, it's the way you explain things. It's still chassidish. It's still, so right. When you say Orthodox, that you're still going to be Orthodox, do you mean in the way that you practice? Or what do you mean when you say that you're still Orthodox?
Yeah, in the way that I practice, because like if it's time to do X mitzvah, whatever X mitzvah is, I'm going to do it with the same way that I learned how to do it, which is going to be in an Orthodox way. The shul that I don't go to is Orthodox. The people that I tend to resonate with are people who get the way that the Orthodox world works. I'm never going to not be an unobservant Orthodox Jew. Like, I'm always going to be that yeshiva bacha. Like, it's never going to go away.
Were there aspects that after these 3 years, or even during these 3 years, that you were missing about the community, or even that you right now miss?
I still miss parts of the community. I still miss some of the camaraderie. I definitely miss the clothes. Seriously.
You can still wear it.
I know, right? Like, I've totally thought many times, like, I just need to go down to my storage unit and get all my Hasidic clothes out.
Do you know how cool it would look on you now? Like, if you make it your own. I have my grandfather's kuchma. Do you know the kuchmas that older guys wear?
Oh, yeah.
I have my grandfather's and I wear it. But I just
So I definitely miss that. The unspoken language that a lot of Hasidim have. Like, you could just walk into a room and be like, new. And everybody instantly knows what you're saying and knows what you mean and like all these other things. And there's so much context that and nuance that I do miss about the Hasidic world. But, you know, I can't get with the homophobia, and I can't get with, especially now, the polarized political attitude. Now, on the real, there's not as much homophobia as I thought there was going to be. After coming out of the closet, I thought I was expecting pitchforks. I was surrounding myself with people who knew how to fight MMA. Like, I was like, that's it. Hasidim are going to attack me. I know it. I was expecting absolute hell. And it ended up not even being like that. I only got one death threat, and it came from somebody in Crown Heights. But as far as like Borough Park and Williamsburg and Flatbush, where I was living at the time, there was Rabbi Yehuda Levin, who is like the Jewish version of Westboro Baptist Church. Like, he's that anti-gay. So he had something to say. But other than that, like, you know, average people didn't have anything negative to say in the Orthodox world. And a lot of the fear that I had was for no reason.
How was your experience as a Jewish person of color?
Oh, so back in the day, there was a lot of racism. The conversion process, I just call it like Selma, Alabama during 1960s, except without the violence. Like, it was that racist during the conversion process. Oh, I mean, I paid a homeless guy one time to have lunch with me because no one would talk to me. Like, oh, it took me a year and a half to find an apartment. It took me 3 years to get my first job in the Orthodox world. Oh, during the conversion process and for a while after that, yeah, there was a lot of racism and xenophobia just in general from people being afraid of the outside world. I found that less the more and more Hasidic someone was, the more like old world Hasidic living in an enclave that someone was, that they tended to be less and less racist. Because a lot of those people didn't identify even as white. They didn't identify as American. They just identified as Jewish. So it's like, oh, I'm Jewish, you're Jewish, whatever. Like, you know, like they would see an Ethiopian or Yemenite or anything like that. It was a non-issue to a lot of people in the really old world communities. I had more problems in your more modern communities. Places where people may have had more interactions with black people and had that interaction with that one ignorant person that turned them off in whatever year it was, or like some kids in Flatbush thinking that they're cool and doing things like using the N-word and stuff like that because they swear that they're down and not realizing how inappropriate it is. Yeah, there was a lot of racism back in the day, but as time would go on, and as I would meet more and more people, and especially having a professional career as being a musician, that would be a lot of the people that were making fun of me in 1999 and 2000 while I was converting, their younger siblings are now buying my album. Their kids are now listening to me. As before, I was somebody they could just dismiss because they saw me on the street. Now they're hearing my music in Galpas, which is a record store in the ultra-Orthodox world. Like now they're, you know, they're you're seeing me in videos with people like Mordechai Ben David and other ultra-Orthodox celebrities. So like once that started happening, it kind of shut the racists up that I had been dealing with. Now I'm dealing with a different kind of racism. People telling me, oh, you're not black, you're Jewish. Or, you know, I mean black people, but I don't mean you. Or, you know, you're not like them. Things like that. Which is one of the reasons why I'm so vocal now for Jews of color. To be like, you know, there is no respectability politics. Like, you know, I'm me and you respect that and that's it.
Did this lead you to create Tribe Herald? Tell us more about it.
Tribe Herald, yes, get to this. So Tribe Herald is a media company, an experience company, an apparel company born out of, well, I spent 6 years at Quartz at QZ.com. I was one of their first developers. So I got to see a media startup from the very beginning all the way to acquisition and inspired me to start my own media company. I was at the time 30 days without alcohol, right now going on just past 9 months. Yeah, after 30 days, which everyone talks about as the hardest, I was feeling like I had extra energy and I had extra time and I really wanted to do something for Jews of color. And I contacted Manish Tana, who's Chase Rishon, who's a rabbi and an author, who's one of my good friends. And I was like, do you think we should start a newsletter for Jews of color? And he goes, I was just on the phone with someone else talking about how we needed that. And I was like, exactly, this is exactly what I'm talking about. At the time, there was no central place that we could all go to find out what Jews of color were doing. Jewish Multiracial Network could be having an event. Then Bechol Lashon could be having an event. Jews of Color Torah Academy, all these other organizations, they all exist, but there was no one place that we could go to find out what everything that was happening. And there was nothing that we could go and consult to find out, you know, if I had a new album, if he had a new book or something like that. And we just wanted to put together a little newsletter that could just be goings on in the Jews of Color world, in the world of Jews of Color. And while we're having these conversations, all those anti-Semitic attacks started happening. In Muncie and in Poe and in Jersey City and all of that started happening. And too many of the perpetrators of these attacks were people of color. And in situations where there's conflicts between white Jewish communities and people of color, who gets caught in the middle? Jews of color. And it was people telling Jews of color, you have to pick a side. Who do you feel more loyal to? Biracial people having fights going on in their own families. And it got to the point that some Jews of color were like, you know, I'm done with the Jewish community. I'm just not going to deal with this. There's too much racism. And if you're going to ask me to always be in explanation mode for 45 million black Americans, and you're asking me to explain why this person does this and that person does that over and over and over again, you know, why deal with white Jews? And so that's what some Jews of color started doing. And Chase and I realized, like, no, we don't need a newsletter. We need a community center. We need a place that we can all go to get some of these feelings out, to start talking about the trauma, the feelings of exclusion, feelings of identity issues, what my family's putting me through, these types of issues, to get them put out into a safe space and a place where we can have workshops and that Jewish organizations for Jews of color can come and give their talks too. And then we're in talks to have this, get this wonderful community center, and we were about to sign a lease on a space in Bushwick, and then Corona happened. So we're not getting any community center. And we put all of our emphasis back into the media side of things and created TribeHerald.com. So tribeherald.com is for the Jewish community, but centered around diversity and inclusion. We are for Jews of color, our friends, allies, loved ones, and supporters. So we're for everybody, just placing Jews of color at the center. And also LGBTQ Jews are also at the center. Starting off with diversity and inclusion first, and then reaching out from there. I had no idea that we would be such a voice for the Native American Jewish community. We have a couple contributors that we say put the tribe in Tribe Herald. Like, they are like really active voices in the Native American Jewish community. And we didn't realize we'd be so much of a voice for the Asian Jewish community. You know, there's a lot of voices out here that are just not being listened to and people think don't exist. And we want to be the voice of those people.
I mean, I so appreciate, besides the importance of it, I so appreciate you putting this out. And so me, as somebody that grew up like Jewish, as a Jewish person, an Ashkenazi Jew, I didn't even know there existed like Asian Jews and Native American Jews. I didn't know that. And I'm like, I'm ashamed to like say I didn't know that. And it's so important that you actually bring these voices so the world knows that, the Jewish community knows that, but also in a greater way that we understand the intersectionalities of identity.
I really love about your story how it's a search for identity, right? And a search for something that you knew clearly who you wanted to be, who you wanted to become, and you went for it. And that call for becoming the person that you really are. And I wonder if anybody who's listening, who is feeling that call, if you could give them some advice to go through this journey and to start this adventure that is becoming oneself.
We get this question a lot. A lot of people saying things like, I'm gay, I'm black, and I live in X small town, but I feel drawn to Judaism. What do I do? One of the things that I hope that I can show is that there's no level of religiosity or no sect or no path of faith that's off limits to anybody. Like, if you are gay or you're a trans kid growing up somewhere in Texas and you feel that you've got to become Satmar Chassid, like, go and go for it. Do your thing. Like, if that's your calling, go for it. It's going to come at a cost, but go for it. No type of faith should be off limits to anybody. And if you're gay and you feel called to something, go for it 100%. You might not be able to stay there. It might not end up being the best thing for you over the long term. But if, you know, don't let somebody tell you that because you're gay, you can't follow your heart or your soul. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me.
I do want to ask one more question. So you were saying about you might not be able to stay there. So I'm wondering, what do you feel that you've taken from all these lessons of learning in the Hasidic world? How has that affected your life in a positive way now?
Well, I mean, honestly, and like I kind of alluded to at the end of the JTA article on this about missing being Hasidic, I don't feel like Borough Park is off limits to me. I may eventually be at a tish one day. I don't feel like that's off limits to me. So like I said, you know, talk about one way that definitely Hasidus, like, I mean, forget it, saved my life, really. would totally be in AA, because as I would come out of drinking every day, that's one of the first, you know, at first step is admit you're powerless to your addiction. Second step is, you know, admit that, you know, a higher power can help save you. And to me, if I wouldn't have had such a strong view of a benevolent Hashem, like, who loves me, like a God that loves me and that I'm always connected to, and like, that connection can never be broken, and who's always there for me, the source of all understanding. Like, if I wouldn't have had that to go back to at that moment, I don't know if I would have made it through, you know, 30, 60, 90 days. Like, I don't think I would have, if I wouldn't have had that God idea, like if my higher power would have been something different, I don't know if it would have, if I would have been successful, but I had that to fall back on. And yeah, little things. If I'm scared, I say Shema. If I'm happy, I'll say a Kapitel Tehillim. If you know, if somebody's sick or something, you say Tehillim. Like just things, Tehillim Psalms. You know, just the way that I express anything spiritual is basically still in that ultra orthodox way. I don't know if I could go back to dealing with the people in the community. I could definitely see myself living in the community. I could see myself like living in the community if I could like selectively see people or something like that, or like have selective hearing or something. But
it's not possible in a community where everybody knows everything.
No, everybody, right. And everyone's within a 6-block radius. But if, you know, if I could have privacy there, I would.
Really appreciate you sharing that advice. I really love people that go towards things that they love in life, that they want to become. And I just think it's a great example and a lot of inspiration can be taken from it.
I think it also built, it seems very also character building, and the fact that you're able to, even with negative responses, like you were, when you said, when you started the conversion therapy process and all that, like even with racism, even with negativity, even with not being accepted, even with like a hard time with your family, like all of that stuff, and like really going after what you want through all that pain, seems like a very character building thing. Like you talked about your rabbi telling you about interviewing yourself. It seems like you've done that a lot in your life.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I don't want to say you only have yourself to blame, but you only have yourself as a motivator sometimes. Mm. So if you don't have that clear vision of what you want, like it, for me, I guess I was just really fortunate to have that, to have like have had such a clear idea of like, all right, I want to exactly be in this zip code. Like this is exactly where I want to be. And I want to be learning this from these people. Like this, like it, because I had that such a clear vision, that kind of, you know, helped me, you know, actually, you know, see me through everything. There was one day particularly, like I can remember after, it was during my Sheva Brachas, after I got married, the 7-day period of festivities after the wedding. And I'm at one of the dinners, and after dessert, I'm sitting there with just a group of middle-aged married guys from Borough Park. And we were sitting there talking about, I forgot what we were even talking about. But at that point, it was like, I felt like, you made it. You are standing here schmoozing with random people in Borough Park about nothing at all. How Hasidish do you want to feel? Like, you know, like you are on 15th Avenue eating like herring with like these people. How accepted do you want to be? When that's the goal, achieving it can kind of feel anticlimactic.
Where can we find more about your platform for Jewish people of color?
TribeAvenue.com is our clothing store. We're going to start having pop-up retail experiences and pop-up community centers in 2021, Corona willing. We're going to hopefully change the face of the Jewish world. I want that Generation Z should be the last generation to say there's somebody who looks Jewish. Like Generation Alpha should be done with all of that. They should be, the following generation should be understanding that everybody comes in all colors. Nothing is off limits to anybody. Everything is for everyone, you know, and that it's not about who accepts you at the end of the day. It's about, you know, do you accept yourself?
Any other spaces where we can find you online that you could share?
So tribeherald.com, and we are Tribe Herald everywhere, at Tribe Herald on Twitter and Instagram, and at tribeavenue.com for all of your clothing and merchandise needs.
Nice. Okay, great. We'll put the link below as well when we put this out.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you
so much. This is so nice. I'm so happy we got to talk to you. I told you, I knew about you for like years because I was in the community. I knew this person, Wyla. Didn't know your story very well, but.
And it all had to happen today. Everything happened.
It did. And I love how you said Corona willing, because there's this thing, God willing, right? And like, right, I love
God
this.
Willing and Corona willing at this
point. Yeah, it's awesome.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been another episode of The Forbidden Apple. I am Melissa Weiss.
I am Pelayo Alvarez.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.